And now we go over to the United Kingdom and welcome back to the programme the excellent Tony Gosling. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Pippa.
Thank you very much for joining. Now then, of course everybody knows your name by now, but there was a time when people would have struggled to put a face to Jeremy Corbyn, but that's not so anymore, is it?
No. I don't know. The guy's been around for a long time, so I suppose anybody that's been...
taken an interest.
A campaigning journalist like me has been coming across him quite a lot, really, over the years. He's been around for a long time. His constituency, Islington North, is very much... I mean, if you think, you know, he's been... I'm not sure how many years he's been there, but he is basically the sitting MP there for decades.
Yes.
And he's seen through lots and lots of different styles of politics. And I think one of the most fascinating things about Jeremy is this whole completely new approach to foreign affairs. Now, there's been this horrible sort of Westminster bubble, Westminster consensus, going on really since 1994, which was the year John Smith died, the former Labour leader, and when Tony Blair took over from him. And so from 94 onwards, really, which is, what is it now, 21 years ago, you've had this cosy consensus at Westminster where everybody kind of agrees with what the city wants, with a kind of internationalist approach, a pro-EU approach, where Britain is kind of just a little small player in a much bigger game, and we've got to do what we're told by the banks.
Well, that's what we refer to really as neoliberalism, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'd like to know, how did that come about?
And privatisation of... I mean, the idea that Labour would, get rid of Clause 4, which, you know, talks in the Labour Party's founding documents about the common ownership of the means of production. Well, I don't know about all production, but certainly there was an understanding in the Labour Party pre-Blair, under John Smith and previous leaders, that, you know, that the main infrastructure of the country should be kept in the hands of the government. And we've seen right across the world, I mean, not least in Russia, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and Perestroika and Gorbachev, you saw the Russian oligarchs basically being handed massive state industries with which they made an absolute fortune before the arrival of Vladimir Putin on the scene, who kind of stopped this privatisation in Russia. So it's been the norm all over the Western world, and including the Soviet Union, that the whole concept of selling things off to your mates, and that being a reason to be in government. And I think this is what has developed this whole thing of career politicians, where they're not really looking at politics. I mean, I look at some of our local politicians and compare them to Jeremy Corbyn, because he's a different type of politician. Mm. He's a conviction politician who everybody knows what Jeremy believes, and he's going to stick to that. And he's not looking to progress up the greasy pole and become a minister or a shadow minister or whatever. He's just been sticking at what he believes. And the trouble with the career politicians is it doesn't finish their aspiration, doesn't finish when they become a minister, they become a secretary of state, or even a prime minister, because they're constantly looking at what they're going to be doing after politics. I mean, you look at people like Blair. They've had this absolute red carpet treatment after politics, which has led to them making an absolute fortune. So, unfortunately, this career politics path isn't really about politics. It's about where you're going to end up in a nice job where you don't have to do anything. You can spend most of your time playing golf in big business.
I think one of the things that's making me really, take a second look every time I hear it come from the MSN when they were talking about Corbyn being, a sort of socialist left potential Labour leader versus the Blairite. And I pinch myself and I think, really, do we still accept... Or would that individual who's being referred to as a Blairite actually really want the word Blair anywhere near their name? Are we that stupid as people to actually think that that candidate is who's towing the Blair line is going to be good for us?
Well, I don't think so, because people have realised, I think, so Blair was very successful, wasn't he, in 97. He took after he took over from John Smith, they had this prawn cocktail offensive in 1996, they called it, where they went around the city basically trying to wine and dine, at least with a few pennies that the Labour Party had left, powerful people in the City of London, in order to get, basically saying to them, look, what do we have to do in order to win this 97 2007 election. We will do anything. And they got various orders from the city, and that's how New Labour and Blair sort of was created. And Blair did rather well. I mean, he stayed, he kept the Labour Party in power despite the Iraq War through the noughties, and right up to 2010, where I would suggest probably the reason that the Labour Party won, lost that 2010 election where the coalition took over, was to do with the way they handled the 2008 financial crisis, you know, the bailout, which people sometimes wrongly call the crash, because of course the bailout was there to prevent the crash. So and that was the sort of slow descent from the Labour victory in 97 right down to what we're effectively now looking at is the present day, you know, with Cameron still in charge. So I think, you know, it's basically the end of New Labour. If Corbyn gets is announced as a new Labour leader tomorrow, and we may also see a split in the Labour Party, because similar things happened over in New Zealand. If you go back a couple of decades, they had a kind of version of New Labour in New Zealand, which was then roundly defeated at a general election with a kind of an old Labour faction, if you can call it that, and their Labour Party split over there, and the new Labour version of the Labour Party in New Zealand just basically, well, it just died a death, because there wasn't any real support for it, only the money that had been backing it. And of course, this is what's behind a lot of this, Pippa, is we're going towards this US system where all that really matters in politics is money, and you can fund any candidate. I mean, for example, Yvette Cooper, who's one of the people standing against Jeremy Corbyn in this Labour leadership contest, her biggest tranche of funding, I'm not sure the exact figure, it's about £35,000.
No, I think it was more. I think it's more like £75,000.
Oh, God, was it?
Yeah.
It comes from a Tory donor.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got, this is no way to run politics if you're just looking at how much money a particular candidate or a particular party is going to get. That should not determine whether or not they get the publicity, that they can hire the biggest spin doctors. And actually, there are other agents involved in all of this that people probably never heard of. And these are these massive strategic communication companies. I mean, they're like public relations on steroids. They're made up, there's one of them, a good example is Strategic Communication Labs. But they're made up of former psychological warfare officers, because the British Army, as most other armies nowadays, train psychological warfare officers. But then these strategic communications firms come and tap these psychological warfare officers on the shoulder and say, well, hey guys, how would you like me to add a zero to your salary on the end of it and come and work for us? And they're basically like a privatised version of the people that have been trained by the army to win wars psychologically. Now, they do that. What they do is they effectively do things like take down enemy communications. They have massive propaganda campaigns, that sort of thing, in order to really demoralise the population. It was used massively in Libya, for example, to undermine support for Colonel Gaddafi within Libya. But these kinds of organisations on the massive scale are used in elections. And one of the tactics that they may be using, and I'm not saying they are, but they may be using in this Corbyn election, is one of the big vulnerabilities is electronic voting. Now, I'm not saying they're doing this, but it's quite feasible through electronic voting that voting can be hacked and votes moved around. It's very difficult to be sure if you're voting electronically. There's no real proper paper trail as to who's voted for who. So there may be possibly even some gerrymandering going on right this minute before this announcement tomorrow.
Well, this announcement tomorrow, as if we understand everything that we've followed with a fine tooth comb over the last few weeks, means that Corbyn is going to be the leader of the Labour Party. But it may perhaps go another way in that case.
Well, you know, I don't think it makes sense to to guess, the second guess what's going to happen. Certainly, the odds are all in favour of Jeremy Corbyn being announced the leader tomorrow. I mean, one of the big so-called reasons that the London media have been giving for Corbyn being some kind of disaster is saying, well, making out that, oh, well, he could never win with his platform. Well, all I do is I just say one word, Scotland.
Yeah.
Because the SNP with conviction politicians and with, actually a critique of the disastrous policies that have been followed since the financial crisis of 2008. We're even talking about having their own currency up in Scotland, weren't they? I mean, let's think about that, how that might work. I mean, you could even do something as imaginative as say, well, as a Scots people, we want to detach our currency from Westminster, from the pound, from the Bank of England, and we want to peg it to, say, the Norwegian krona. You know, you can start to do really imaginative things. Of course, the krona is doing really well as a currency. And, you know, you can start to then use imaginative ways to detach your or get rid of your reliance on the absolute disaster that's going on in the general economy in the West with the banksters, you know, the European Central Bank actually tearing Greece to pieces. Poor old Greeks. I mean, you know, this is a form of... I mean, I was talking about the psychological warfare. That's psychological warfare. What about economic warfare? We've seen this going on in terms of sanctions against the Russians, this kind of thing, against Iran, against other countries. But this economic warfare is now almost taking place against ordinary people too. So our governments have used these tactics against foreign countries, against enemies, but they're now starting to use them against the disabled here in Britain. I mean, one of the more recent things I was reading about was they're talking about taking away mobility allowance from the disabled here in Britain now, which means, you know, for thousands of disabled, well, tens of thousands of disabled people, they won't actually have the extra little bit of money they need every week to leave their homes. I mean, what kind of world are we creating for ourselves? We are attacking the very people that need the government the most, and they're starting to run government like it's some kind of profit-making business, which it isn't.
Well, you talk about imaginative policies. I mean, what about Clause 4 and the potential reinstating of that? Is that realistic?
Totally realistic. Look, we had the perfect example to show you how and why it is looking at the East Coast Main Line. That's been being run it was renationalised after there were some problems with the franchisee about 3 or 4 years ago. And it's been number one, absolutely head and shoulders above everybody, all the other train companies, in terms of customer satisfaction, coming in on time, decent service, and it's also returned more money to the Department of Transport, to the Exchequer, to the Treasury, than any of the other rail franchises. So it's just greed and it's cronyism which is allowing certain parts of Britain, just like the Russian oligarchs did with Russian industries and Russian infrastructure back in the 90s. You know, it's only greed that's and cronyism which is allowing these kind of massively important public services like a massive railway network to be put in the hands of private companies. I mean, just one example, the Paddington to Bristol, where I live, that route is run by First Great Western, it's called. Now, their service is appalling. Every time I get on a train, it seems to get less and less space, so we're put in, it's like a cattle truck now. It used to be a nice, you could spread your legs out and there was seats facing each other, this kind of thing. Now you're crushed in like a cattle truck. And also, one of the main reasons for this is because First Group is servicing a massive multi-billion debt in the US. So you're not even going, when you're paying your fare, to your own services. It's not going to the service that you're actually riding on the train. It's going to service a massive debt in America somewhere. So basically, it's the banksters again, yeah? It's the banks. The money is just going straight as interest payments to a bank somewhere. And that's why we need to, you know, Jeremy's absolutely right about the railways. If you want to go back far enough, the reason the railways were dismantled in the 60s, that was just simply because the Americans said, if you want to develop a North Sea oil, you're going to have to open up your own market for oil in Britain. And so, obediently, Dr. Beeching shut down the railways. And we had the best railway network in the world was closed down. So one of the reasons we've got so many deaths on our roads, so much pollution due to cars, you can't park anywhere. You've got massive congestion in all the major cities, particularly here in Bristol, actually, is because of the oil industry. And it's nothing to do with the free market. That's the reason why we've got this crazy situation situation today where the transport market is basically it's a racket.
Tony, I want to, I mean, you've mentioned oil there, and I'm going to try and make a spurious link to something else I wanted to ask you about. We haven't got much time, but today we hear the news that the Russian government is going to be providing support to Syria's Assad regime in fighting against against ISIS. Now, we're seeing the ongoing Saudi Arabian bombing of Yemen, and of course this all with the backdrop of the Iran-America nuclear deal, which of course the Republicans are trying and failing to overturn. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think that probably the biggest tragedy going on right now is this bombing of Yemen. The reason I say it's partly is because the Brits are profiting out of it, the British arms industry and the British jets, some of which are being used in these attacks. I mean, first of all, it's the terrorism of the worst sort, of a mass slaughter. Never mind someone who might be going to Syria and who might be thinking about becoming a terrorist rather than visiting their family, which is the sort of stuff we get splashed across our newspapers. This is, I think it's now a total of 6,000 dead in Yemen.
This is the Middle East's poorest country. Yeah. Being attacked by the Middle East's richest country.
Yeah, that's right. And the other ironic thing about what's going on in Yemen, which is, again, not talked about on the BBC, is that the Houthi rebels, they call them, but the Houthis were making real inroads into destroying ISIS in the southeast of Yemen, at which point, out of the blue, comes loads of bombs from the sky on top of their heads, from our bombs, by the way, our munitions, built here in Britain, onto the heads of the poor old Houthis. And so what are they supposed to think? So maybe we shouldn't have been attacking ISIS. Now, look, this really kicks back into Syria, doesn't it? Because what's happening there is we've had a year of America and Britain supposedly fighting ISIS, dropping bombs, well, actually also dropping guns for them. And what the Americans have said is that, oh, sorry, this is a mistake, that the weapons that we airdropped and that went straight to ISIS, we dropped to the wrong people in the wrong place. You know, so I think what we're looking at is theatre, actually. It's a theatre, probably one of the most hideous acts of humanity ever, to pretend that you're fighting ISIS when actually what you're doing is helping them, supplying them. What they're doing, actually, most of the air raids have missed ISIS, and this is the US air raid, have been hitting Iraqi villages. So they've been killing ordinary Iraqis. They've been destroying, for example, in Erbil, the university was blown to bits by American Air Force. But they've not been making a dent in ISIS. So the arrival of the Russians in Syria is going to be a real litmus test for how serious are we about trying to destroy ISIS. Because I would suggest, with the Russians involved in the fight against ISIS, sitting next to the Syrian Arab army of Assad, that they will probably be able to make mincemeat of them within weeks. Mm. And then there'll be an end to ISIS, because I actually think that the whole ISIS business, that is, it's sort of translated last year from our good friends, the Syrian Free Syrian Army, the rebels, and they suddenly became ISIS, didn't they, mm-hmm. middle of last year?
Yeah.
Out the good guys suddenly become the bad guys. I think they're still the good guys in the official NATO book. And if you look at where these sorts of operations are run from as well, very few people have heard of it, but it's called CENTCOM. I mean, they have a thing called AFRICOM and CENTCOM, but the US Pentagon has basically divided the world up into whole areas, and they run these wars from, I mean, CENTCOM, I believe, is in Stuttgart in Germany. I know AFRICOM is, because no African nation would allow the Americans to have their headquarters there. But there is this covert system going on where the Pentagon isn't running these wars openly and in public, and it's not telling the journalists what they're doing. What they're doing is they're running them from behind the scenes. So I would like to see AFRICOM and CENTCOM shut down. You know, what are they doing? What they're doing effectively is they're saying, well, look, we're outside the jurisdiction of US law, so we can project US power post 9/11 anywhere we want in the world. Well, my answer to that is no, you can't. And I think the Russians would say the same.
Well, we've got Saudi Arabia sort of, you know, with its allies looking to, in its own words, I suppose, pacify Yemen. But the inference is actually that its message is clearly towards Iran, and that is that that Iran is the problem here in the Middle East as far as Saudi Arabia and America and Israel certainly is concerned.
Well, it's only a problem because it won't do what it's told, that it's an independent country. I mean, look what happened in Ukraine is another example. You're not allowed, I'm afraid, to be an independent country anymore. Certainly if you're anywhere close to the front lines between East and West in the Middle East. And, you know, the Iranians are quite within their rights to develop nuclear power. Mm. Everyone is quite within their rights to say, well, hang on a minute, we want to make sure you don't get any nuclear weapons. But are the Israelis within their rights to have something like 120, 150 nuclear weapons that they don't declare? Are they within their rights to have submarines in the Mediterranean that can just pop up, fire a cruise missile, which might possibly, by the way, have a nuclear weapon on the end of it, wherever they want? I mean, because this is the sort of question that needs asking. The other thing, of course, about Syria is they have a base, the Russians have a base there. So the Russians don't want, I mean, it's just for the Mediterranean. And they've been threatened by the West in Crimea, in the Black Sea. They may possibly lose that base there if they lose the Crimea. And they're also being threatened in Syria. So what's happening is the Russians are being... I mean, we don't hear a lot about the big geostrategic stuff going on here, but both in Syria and in Ukraine, the Russians have been surrounded, and there's been an attempt to really take their traditional, if you can call it that, strong military points. Now, the thing is, if the Russians are pushed out from the Russian Navy, is pushed out of the Mediterranean, that's it. The Americans can do what they want. They can attack Syria, bomb Syria, etc., and no one can stop them. So this is why I think the Russians are saying, well, hang on a minute, we're actually not going to let Ukraine fall, and we're not going to let Syria fall. So this, I guess, is going to be the test. The only problem here, Pippa, is if we start to get accidental so-called friendly fire or Russian troops engaging with US troops in Syria, somewhere like that. That then could start to get nasty.
And so, Tony, what of the Iranian Obama nuclear deal? Because the fact is that, you know, Israel have responded badly to that. Some of many Republicans responding badly to that. And, of course, we see Khamenei from Iran yesterday saying, well, Israel's not going to be existing in 25 years.
Well, I don't know about Israel not existing in 25 years. I certainly think...
He's
right in a way, in that there are quite a lot of countries around the world that don't have a kind of embedded democracy. That is, they do not have... I mean, you know, if you were to knock out a few of the leaders of quite a few countries, and then the whole system would collapse. And Israel actually could be one of those, because although it has a democracy like we supposedly have here in Britain, there are a small number of basically terrorists and security specialists who are hanging on to power. And they're doing, you know, probably spending as much time as they are doing their job in trying to make sure nobody else takes that power off them. So you start then to get rather fragile regimes that can be knocked over. You know, somewhere like Russia isn't like that. Iran is not like that, because they've got actually a very deep structure, more democratic structure. So you've got hundreds and hundreds of people who are all pretty much on the same page. If you kill a few leaders, then it's not, the whole system isn't going to fall over. As the Americans discovered, which, by the way, I didn't know this, but in 1981, a US-backed group blew up the entire cabinet of Iran, killing the prime minister and the president and a load of other ministers. Now, we don't hear a lot about that, but that sounds like terrorism to me by America against Iran. I mean, I was at a conference just last week, in Tehran. Well, they flew me over, which was rather nice of them, but to meet some of the victims of 17,000 victims of terrorism within Iran, who've been blown up, killed, shot, murdered since the 1979 revolution. And, you know, okay, so Iran isn't a perfect society. They probably don't have as much freedom of speech as we have, but we've got this weird thing in the West now where you have freedom of speech, you can go and shout and holler on a street corner, but you don't get the right to be heard through the mainstream media. And this, in a way, is what Jeremy Corbyn is bringing back, if I can come back to him. Mm. The reason that the London press, that the establishment is so afraid of him is not because he can come to power, because he probably won't for at least 5 years. Even if he does do rather well, it's because it's going to actually open up the discussion, open up the debate, open up the narrative.
Yeah.
Things are going to start to be questions that haven't been questioned for 20 years. So effectively, you know, Corbyn it's the media revolution that Corbyn may bring in, which they're most afraid of.
And the timing being so perfect, because of course all of us with information at our fingertips means that everybody can get involved, and that's also, you know, the power of Twitter in situations like this can't be underestimated.
Well, everyone can say stuff, but you see, it's really by controlling the BBC. I mean, you know, what we've just been talking about, you won't hear a lot about that on the BBC. I mean, also, for example, the fact that ISIS have thrived over the last year since Britain and America have been attacking them, the fact that the oil tankers are not being stopped, that are making loads of money for ISIS, the fact that you can go into the headquarters of ISIS in Mosul and you can pay by MasterCard, Visa, you know, all these British, you know, diners club even. You know, you would think that it would be very easy, well, of course it is very easy, to close these people down. They could do it in the blink of an eye if they really wanted, but they don't want. And these are the sorts of conversations that I've been hearing and joining in pubs and cafes and things around Britain. And I'm sure they do exactly the same in the US and other parts of Europe, but they're absolutely deliberately been shut out of the mainstream press, you know, the Sky, the BBC, all these kinds of things here in Britain, which is really frustrating. You know, they think that actually they can run the entire country by pretending that the only things that are going on are the things that are going on in the national press. Then they've got another thing coming.
Indeed they have. And Tony Gosling, I know that you've been incredibly generous with your time. Thank you, because you've got to get ready for your own radio programme. Can we refer my listeners to your radio programme, please?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And tonight we'll be doing something on Nazi hunting in South America, which is some new information we've got about something called Colonia Dignidad, which was a place where some of the top Nazis were actually running this whole area of Chile up in the mountains between Argentina and Chile after the Second World War. And I've spoken to one of the people who, after the Pinochet, because of course the Pinochet government in Chile was protecting and helping them, and I was privileged enough to speak to one of the people who was over in Chile once Pinochet was kicked out and we had a socialist government in Chile over 2 or 3 years, one of the people that helped shut this Nazi camp down.
And how can we access your radio program?
Oh, it's on, it's on thisweek.org.uk.
Thisweek.org.uk.
You can listen to it live or download a podcast afterwards.
Excellent. Tony Gosling, you're always brilliant and you haven't failed us today. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Lots of love, Pippa. Thanks.
Bye.